What I believe. My belief is that we should definitely not have beliefs. I'm kidding, kind of. But considering the only constant in the universe is change itself, I guess I technically can't believe what I only mostly believe now will be my entire belief tomorrow. But I'm going to give it a shot. So I'm a bit of a science nerd. My singing and directing are pretty visible here, but before I had kids, I was a kickboxing instructor and a high school physiology, medical terminology, and biology teacher. I'm also into very obscure mystical traditions like astrology, sound healing, ETs, a pretty strong hybrid of mystic woo-woo meets science geek, and a pretty blatant contradiction. So, to tell you or to let you into my brain for a few minutes, imagine cupping a marble in the center of your palm. It's solid and predictable. Science used to tell us existence was made of similar solid marbles, like a giant mechanical machine. But then scientists zoomed way in past the electron down to the bedrock of reality, where solidity should have been, what? An absence of physicality, and instead a universe of vibration and possibility itself. Energy was no longer thought of as a continuous linear stream. One of the most ancient mystical philosophies, Hermeticism, recognizes that the universe doesn't work like a cold machine. It works like a mind. Modern quantum physics suggests these mystics weren't unscientific, they were thousands of years ahead of their time. I love the idea that as science progresses, the gap between it and mystical phenomena appears less like a superstition or the paranormal, and more like a hidden treasure, always existing but patiently waiting for our understanding and tools to catch up. Thousands of years ago, our current technology would have looked like absolute magic, and we would have been legit wizards. Psh, bow to me, young Padawans. Bow before me. there are seven hermetic principles, and I could talk for days about this, but I'll touch on just a few of them. The first one is the principle of mentalism. It states, the all is mind, the universe is mental. Simply put, consciousness, awareness, is the core and full breadth of all existence at once, and the precursor to collapsed physical matter. For a long time, science laughed at this, but then came quantum mechanics and a phenomenon called the observer effect. Imagine a spinning coin on a table. Is it heads or tails? It's actually a blur of both possibilities, only becoming definitively heads or tails the moment you slap your hand down to stop it. Particles, like electrons, actually act just like a spinning coin. When not observed, particles behave like fluid waves of possibility and probability, interacting instantaneously in multiple places at once, regardless of the space between them. That's spatial non-locality. Side note, they also possess temporal non-locality outside time, but time is a linear construct, and everything happening here and now is a conversation that I have to wait on because it's really long. But I want to. another time. Back to the observer effect. As shown in the famous double slit experiments, the most famous from the 1960s, the instant waves are interacted with, they snap into physical particles. They derive out of waveforms, imperceivable physically until they're mingled with. Hold up. Waves know that they're being observed. How? The implications are absolutely mind-blowing. Okay, because this suggests intelligence. The universe, it turns out, requires a mind to look at it before it decides how to look. Max Planck, the scientist who introduced quantum mechanics, said, "I regard consciousness as fundamental. I regard matter as derivative from consciousness." This leads us to the principle of vibration, which states nothing rests, everything moves, everything vibrates. The chair you're sitting on feels completely solid, right? But quantum physics proves solidity is an illusion. There is no out there. This is quantum field theory. The field, like an invisible ocean, ripples with those non-physical waves. Depending on the culture, the field from which all things emanate is called prana, chi, ether, the force. Even Obi-Wan, Star Wars, says, the Force surrounds and penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together. And Yoda taught Luke to clear his mind to access this Force. Just as an MEG machine can pick up brainwaves outside of the skull without even touching the head, perhaps our computer brains can work the other direction too, downloading information like creative ideas all at once, straight from that field. In a letter from 1815, Mozart explained, "All this inventing takes place in a pleasing, lively dream. I keep conceiving the work more and more clearly. I do not hear in my imagination the parts successively, but I hear them, as it were, all at once, a download." When consciously accessed, this sea of awareness, the collective unconscious, as Carl Jung calls it, markedly reduces stress and improves cognitive function. To quote the great Nikola Tesla, everything is vibration. The day science begins to study non-physical phenomena, it will make more progress in one decade than all the previous centuries of its existence. Next is the principle of correspondence. Maybe you've heard the axiom, as above, so below. Modern scientists agree with the ancients that the macrocosm is mirrored in the microcosm and vice versa. A fractal, like in digital computing, is when all the information in a larger something is contained in its entirety in each of its individual parts. Fractal spirals exist at every level of the universe, from the Milky Way to hurricanes to sunflowers to our very own DNA. So what's up with fractals and why focus on them? If existence itself is a repeated fractal, then every fractal emanates from some single source. The all are the one and the one are the all. Like a cosmic hologram or computer, the universe appears to embed its architecture within every seemingly independent fragment, allowing even the smallest repeating leaf to mirror the infinite intelligence of the entire forest. This is actually the basis of one of my favorite languages, the one I'm currently formally studying, the language of astrology. The basis of one of my favorite languages. And the concept is, as above, so below. This brings me to the law of polarity. John, would you bring me my water? I'm thirsty. Okay, thank you. I can't get through all seven principles, by the way. I'd love to talk about all of them, but. Okay. The law of polarity. We recognize this in there's two sides to every coin. All paradoxes can be reconciled, where things can be this and that. Apparent opposites, like hot and cold, exist on either end of the same sliding scale, temperature. With this principle, maybe dualistic thinking, us versus them, can actually be reconciled. I see humanity as having capacity for unity consciousness. Like differing human cell types, seemingly disconnected in function with narrow perspectives within their own little worlds, when viewed from a higher vantage point, we clearly recognize they are the same perspectives of the same one thing. Different perspectives of the same one thing. So to wrap up here, I do believe, at least for now, that when I look at you, I am seeing a reflection of my own essence and vice versa. And not just as a cute idealistic sentiment. There are no actual boundaries between my existence and where it ends and yours begins. The scientist in me sees a strong possibility that we are quite literally reflected fractals of the same one thing, having different experiences. Like peering through multiple windows. I think Merlin has a song along these lines. And I think at Chalice especially, we innately know a peaceful reality can already be there waiting for us, waiting to collapse into particle form. It seems that vision drives us into action and community. That's why I love all of you people. You're like my soul family, if there is such a thing. And if you like all of this, what I've said, then cool. And if you consider me the town woo-woo, that's fine. It's a win for me. You can always come talk to me about astrology, or I can be your UFO hunting buddy, or talk about topics that are usually reserved for brownie eaters. It's apparently how my brain just works in its natural state. Okay, guys, thank you for listening. I love you all. And may the Force be with you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't know if this is far up. There you go. You may have noticed I'm a little tall. Good morning. I'm David Jackson. My pronouns are universal. I'm a child of the universe, same as the trees and the stars. I believe that nurture is the most important part of raising a child. I believe that a great deal of the troubles in the world are the fact that people have failed to properly nurture their children. I will use my own life as an example of the effect of nurturing. When you look at the color of my skin, you might assume that I am black in all the iterations of that word. If you do, then you'd be judging a book by its cover. I am not black. I am human. I grew up in a multi-ethnic, multicultural, multilingual city of East Chicago, Indiana, in a steel-producing town. On one end of the block that I grew up on was an AME church, African Methodist Episcopal Church. On the other end was an Irish bar. Across the street from the bar was a kosher grocery store owned by Holocaust survivors. My immediate neighbor on one side of the house was Italian immigrant, Mr. Planetto. He was a knife sharpener. He had a big wheel of stone, and he went up and down the street and sharpened knives and saws. He would sit there every day and just use a saw. He was great. I learned a lot from him. On the other side were two Mexican families, one of whom turned out to be my godparents. On my block also lived African Americans, Puerto Ricans, Austrians. Well, we suspected they were really German. But you know, after the war, like, you know, not me. I'm not. So, but we also had Cubans, Poles, Caribbean Islanders, and Serbians. I learned to speak a little bit of all of those languages because a lot of them could not speak English very well. Okay. Each of those families kind of adopted me into their family because I didn't have a father with me. My father lived in New York. So these are the people in the village that raised me. How do I identify? I identify as human. That village taught me to be proud of who I was, not what I was. About my pronouns, gender neutral. As Jill Slaus talked about in the service a few weeks ago, in Carl Jung's archetypes, there's a divine masculine that is associated with outward focus, action, logic, protection, structure, and the doing. The divine feminine is focused on inward discovery, intuition, nurturing, creativity, and being. As she said, in Hinduism, the masculine and the feminine are not competing entities, but two halves of the same whole. I am that whole. Two halves. The hardworking men of my family and the neighborhood nurtured the masculine side of me because it was easy. I was a boy, and that's what men do. But I give credit to my mother, the women of the families of my family and my neighborhood for nurturing my feminine side. As I grew up, it became the wife in my family. Meaning I did the housework. I learned to cook, clean, do the laundry, the ironing, the dishes, mop the floors, all the things that were considered housework, woman's work. And because my mother was a tailor seamstress, she taught me how to sew and to do alterations. And to him, for you guys, you don't know what that is, but and I was really good at it. Okay. I was proud of what I could do. I didn't consider it woman's work. I just considered my job, my contribution to the family. On Saturday mornings, my grandmother and my aunts came to the house for coffee and conversation. And I think partly they came to the house because mine was the cleanest. Okay. But I got to listen. I had to become invisible, but I got to listen to the conversations. I became in tune with the feminine side. By listening, I learned a great deal. And I gained an appreciation for the female. So as I said, I believe that nurture, not nature, is the best way to raise a child.
I'm jealous of you. I can only hem and haw. I can't hem. I don't know who went over there and went, ugh. Everybody, okay. Thanks, Pamela. I appreciate you keeping me humble. One of the things that I think is fascinating about age is that it seems for many that as you age, there's a default, a perspective. Now, that's not 100% happening all the time for anyone. And for some people, they're very, very, very stringent in their belief structures. So, Katie, I agree with you. Our beliefs at their best should be fluid and dynamic, and that we learn, and as we learn, we have the ability to alter. But more importantly, I think one of my biggest beliefs is accountability. I think it's fine to be wrong. I embrace when I'm wrong. I own when I'm wrong. Wrong is just a perspective. It's not right or wrong. It's just it didn't work out the way that you thought it was going to. It was different. The outcome was not expected. You were very cocksure of yourself. I was very cocksure of myself and how something would land. But it didn't. Well, it landed, but it didn't land the way I thought it was going to. And when I was younger, I was quite sure that I was not going to own it. I did everything in my power to blame something else. That cost me. That cost me a lot. As time went on, and I got older, I started shutting up and listening. And as I listened, I came to understand the power of that. The power of learning from those around you. The power of willing to not be cocksure. The power of forgiving yourself and others in the context of a bigger conversation. Of growing. Of being human. Beliefs to me are a hindrance. Now, my history is the reason for that belief, and that belief could be wrong. I think it's important that as we go through our lives, as we teach others, as we pass torches, to share that perspective, to allow children to embrace that things do alter, that the sun does not rise and fall by your dictum, that parents can be wrong, in quotes. So, the bigger belief that I have, though, that allows me a lot of forgiveness, is my belief in the power of humor, the power of laughter, the power of joy, indeed, the power of love. Love. There's a word. There's something I truly believe in. Love grants all the power to be wrong and to come off your high horse. The power to cherish. The power to embrace. The power to forgive. The power to look in someone's eyes and share a moment with them. The thing that I love about yes, I believe in making sure that you do not anger the technical gods. Oh, now I've done it. All right. Guess I have to know my place. I don't want to hear about it, Pamela. Love. It is the community that we are in. It is the community that we create. It is the focus of this religion, of this spiritual traveling circus that we are in. It is a circus who I hope I live to spend a long time traveling with. I ask that as people think about their belief structures today and tomorrow and whenever it comes up, that they give themselves the grace of perspective, the grace of age, the grace of forgiveness, the grace of laughter, the grace of humor. And with Merlin sitting right there, the grace of music. The grace of music.